welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, sound editors, sound mixers, film editors, casting directors, stunt coordinators, composers. I've been doing so much talking the past several weeks, especially with getting with artisans for potential Emmy consideration. It's all starting to blur. But never so blurry that I'm not ready to talk to somebody else or talk to all of you today. And I'm very excited about today's show because I have two exclusive interviews for you with two filmmakers. I love their work. The first one is Carlisle Eubank joins me to talk about his feature directorial debut of Broke. And then at the midpoint of the show, or slightly thereafter, depending how long I ramble on with you, another interview with the fantastic director, James Bamford. I adore James. I love his films. He is just, it's always fun to get on the phone and talk to him. Or his, you know, and or his producing partner and story guy, Stephen Paul. You get the two of them together, as you may have heard on some prior interviews that we've done over the past year. And it's just a laugh riot. But still taking the filmmaking very seriously. But before I get to James later in the show and his film, The Last Gunfight, we're going to talk about Carlisle Eubank and Broke. Now, you know, it's long been said to write what you know. Well, that's exactly what writer-director Carlisle Eubank has done with Broke. Some of you might recognize Carlisle's name, and if you do, it's probably thanks to The Signal, which came out about 11 or so years ago, which was written by Carlisle and directed and co-written by his brother William. Or maybe you saw his film Muzzle, starring Aaron Eckhart, which Carlisle co-wrote with William and which was directed by John Stahlberg Jr. But as Carlisle now steps into the director's chair with Broke, let me tell you, this is 100% Carlisle Eubank. Riding horses since before he could walk, Carlisle grew up living the Western lifestyle, often helping his neighbors gather, sort, ship, and brand their cattle, and he still does that today. And I know now, you, thanks to Taylor Sheridan and Yellowstone, and even 1923 or 1883, you now understand what all of this branding, gathering, sorting, and shipping with cattle is all about. But Carlisle is familiar with all aspects of the modern-day cowboy life, so it makes perfect sense that his first directorial feature, and with the script written solely by him, would be a Western. Described as a contemporary Western, this Broke follows the story of True Brandywine, who is exquisitely played by Wyatt Russell. True is a bareback bronc rider clinging to a fading rodeo career. When True gets trapped in a freak spring blizzard, he has to battle his injuries, he gets buried in snow, he gets stuck in a freezing cold abandoned cabin, he gets sick, he battles that, and the more he battles, the colder it gets. While fighting for his survival, True is forced to face his choices in life and the circumstances that led him to where he now is. Cinematography is superb and excellently executed as poor True is delirious due to the cold and no food. No water, no flame to melt snow to have water. But it's not played, flashbacks are not played as you would normally expect. with black and white or sepia toned or blurred or, you know, super saturated, blown out white sun. It's all very natural. It's really lovely the way that it's done. But joining Wyatt as True, Dennis Quaid, who plays his father, George, and Mary McDonnell, who you all will remember from Dances with Wolves, plays his mother, Mary. Veteran actor Tom Skerritt is on board, as is Johnny Berchtold, who plays True's younger brother, Caleb. There is great emotional depth and texture here, thanks to an incredibly well-crafted and complex character in True Brandywine, providing what feels almost like a meditative concept on life, showcasing the complexities not only within True, but within all of us. Your parents want you to do one thing. You have your own mindset in your heart. You have your own mindset. Your heart is pulling you in another direction, even though you might not be making money, but you're happy. What outweighs what? Who do you listen to? Where do you go? There is not a person anywhere that I don't think will not be able to relate to True Brandywine and his life, where he is in his life. In our exclusive interview here that you're about to hear, Carlisle and I discuss the film script to screen. We break it down, talk about the immersive and beautiful cinematography of Charlie Saroff, the creative use of flashbacks, shooting in different seasons on location in Montana to create the passage of time as well as the natural visual differences. We even get into the challenges of filming in harsh winter conditions, including equipment failures and the need for some CGI to maintain continuity, such as with snowflakes. I love our snowflake discussion. It's a lot of fun. And as you watch this and you understand, when you see the film and you see Wyatt Russell buried in snow and a blizzard that is raging, you will understand why for all those seasons of Yellowstone, Taylor Sheridan waited until April or May to shoot the next season of the show after the harsh winters were gone. So it's really interesting to hear Carlisle's take on all of this, being in the thick of it all. And rodeos. True is a broken down bronc buster. Well, you got to have rodeos. And we get them. There's actual rodeo footage and bronc busting from about 6 different rodeos around the state of Montana that Carlisle and the crew traveled to and filmed at. We also cover the casting, with much of the film's success attributed to not only the immersive storytelling, but the strong performances of Dennis Quaid and Wyatt Russell capturing the complex father-son dynamic. And of course, let's not forget Glenn Garland's seamless editing. So, I will shut up, and you can take a listen as Carlisle Eubank discusses the wonderful contemporary Western Broke. Hey, Carlisle.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Terrific. Otherwise, we can just do a Verizon commercial. That's good, too.
Perfect.
I have to tell you, Carlisle, I am beyond impressed with Broke. This,
thank you.
It belies this being your first directorial feature.
Thank you. Very encouraged to hear
this. This is absolutely stunning. You can tell, number one, it's a very personal story. Obviously, the old mantra, write what you know, you clearly have done that, because had you not, we would not have the depth and texture that we see in True Brandywine.
Yeah.
An incredibly, incredibly well-crafted character within what, to me, feels like a very meditative concept on life.
Mm-hmm.
And
correct.
It really showcases the complexities not only within true, but within all of us. Your parent wants you to do one thing. You have your own mindset and your heart pulling you in another direction. Even though you might not be making money, but you're happy. What outweighs what and where do you go? And there is not a person anywhere that I don't think cannot relate to that.
Thank you. Yeah, I hoped that by being very, very specific, that it would actually become very universal.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember when I watched movies that were about very specific subtext or subcultures or read books in high school or college that were about very specific things. I always felt, even though maybe I wasn't part of that culture or subgroup, I tended to still really relate to characters. And it was all so fun because it was a window into maybe a world that I wasn't as familiar with, which is always more interesting in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was trying to do the inverse of that by sort of showing something very personal to me and something very subcultural, but then trying to hopefully mine it enough to make it universal.
Well, I think you definitely succeeded, Carlisle.
Thank you.
Because just watching True, and this is particularly relevant in the way you've structured this story, and I have to compliment you on the story structure itself. Mm-hmm. And the way that you're telling this story, essentially through flashbacks, when True is out there caught in a blizzard. But working with your DP, working with Charlie Saroff, these never look like flashbacks. When you think flashbacks, everything gets all, it fades out, vintagey on the edges, it's sepia, it's black and white, it's your color balance is differentiated.
Right.
It's not. What you do here is we are immersed in that moment of time in True's mind's eye, and it's as vivid right now as it was when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very contemporaneous with the situation. It's not, he's reliving everything in his mind's eye as he struggles to stay alive. And this structure is so key to telling this story because we feel the immediacy. Nothing is in the past. It is all right here within his grasp, just like it's right here within our grasp. Just incredibly wonderfully done, Carlisle.
Thank you. Yeah, the flashbacks are always sort of, you're sort of scared off of them by people saying, oh, you can lose your audience and, you can confuse people or distract people. But I think two things that kind of like helped us in that regard was we shot the different timelines for the most part in two completely different seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we shot in two different schedules and Montana looks radically different in July than it does in February. So that helps just in terms of the actual natural light and just, snow versus no snow. So that helps, but also I was really, really, really intentional about the threads that connect us from present to past and past to present. Mm-hmm. I tried to, and this might sound a little silly, but I remember in college, I read a book that was incredibly formative for me called The Metamorphoses by Ovid.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretentious, but I don't remember a lot of books, but I remember that one because in this sort of old poem, he would do these really interesting literary transitions, and they weren't always narrative. Sometimes they were just textural transitions. Sometimes they were just a sound. Sometimes they were just something you saw. And I thought, wow, that is so psychologically, delicate. And so I tried to do that in this. Like, I tried to make the transitions not always the most obvious thing. Sometimes they're just, like, a little phrase. Sometimes they're a sound. Sometimes they're just, like, a theme. And so I was just sort of hoping that by doing that, I wouldn't confuse people, and so far people, generally speaking, seem to stay hooked, and so I'm really grateful that that worked.
It worked beautifully. It really does. You forget that you're going back and forth because you are so
right.
absorbed in
right.
the character of True, but also in Charlie's beautiful lensing.
Oh,
I don't
yeah,
care.
He does such a good job.
I don't care if it's the snow, the blizzard, when
right.
and poor Wyatt. I hope he got hazard pay. On in some capacity for actually getting
him. I don't think so.
And he is a producer, so maybe he gave himself something nobody knows about.
Being
buried in the snow. And this is what I hope people don't miss, is that you actually shot this in a Montana winter. There's a reason that that Taylor Sheridan did not shoot Yellowstone during the winters and would wait
right.
to come back and shoot his seasons in
right.
April or May, because
right.
this is what winter in Montana is.
It is, and we just, you know, we didn't have any sort of resources to fabricate it. So in a weird, in sort of a strange counterintuitive way, we were praying for the worst weather possible, you know, and that is true. And that was like, I remember going into that, we shot the winter portion first in February. And so that, in a strange way, kind of became my first film, because it was like shooting a short film, you know what I mean? Because we were going to take a break after 10 days of shooting in the weather. And so I remember just sitting down and going, all right, what are the big problems that we're going to encounter? And the number one problem that I wrote down was good weather. we needed bad weather. And so actually the challenge became, what do we do if the sun breaks through the clouds and suddenly this nasty day suddenly looks good and then the story doesn't work? So I kind of came up with a bunch of contingency plans, like trying to choose some locations that were in the shadow so that even if the sun was out, if generally speaking the environment was in a shadow, then I thought we could cheat it. And so that's what we did. We had a couple days that were actually bluebird skies. And so like the river crossing was shot during a perfectly blue day.
Wow.
And so that we just ran to that location and shot it in a shadow. And so it still sells that darker. Anyways, that became the production challenge of it. And that's, you know, anytime the weather was really bad and it was freezing, the cameras didn't work, I was just kind of weirdly riding a high, because it was like, good, we're getting what we need, you know?
You are a glutton for punishment, Carlisle.
I suppose so.
And I
just knew what we needed to do, I guess.
And you brought up one of the very interesting points from a technical standpoint, is how adversely was your equipment affected by the cold and by the snow? I know there are plenty of cheats around it to insulate, wrap things in plastic,
yeah,
all
yeah.
of this.
Yeah.
But when it gets so cold, there is nothing that's going to help you.
No, like on the really cold days, like we were in what's called a polar vortex. So I think with the wind chill, it was like negative 25 to 30. And there really isn't much you can do. What we ended up doing for a lot of stuff was, you know, those like hand warmers people
yeah.
use when they go skiing.
Mm-hmm.
We would just strap a ton of those to the batteries. That tended to help, but we still had things fail and we'd have to swap batteries or wait till things warmed back up, like run them to a truck and try to warm them up. So yeah, we were always trying to mitigate that. Luckily, we had a lot of good local crew that
mm-hmm.
wasn't super unfamiliar with that kind of adverse weather. So primarily, like mostly speaking, we were able to get past it, but there were definitely days where we were getting bogged down by that stuff.
Yeah. I've spoken with many cinematographers over the years, and it's, you know, yeah, they love it because of the visuals you can get. The lighting and lensing is supreme,
mm-hmm.
but then you've got to deal with these technical challenges. The same thing on the contrary, you know, contrary to that, when you're out in the desert, I've spoken with filmmakers that have been
yeah.
there when a sandstorm has come
yes.
up. And that's
yeah.
even worse because the sand gets into the camera housing.
So bad. I actually have experience with that. My first movie that I wrote was called The Signal, like 10, 11, 12 years ago. And we shot it in New Mexico, and we got one of those sandstorms. And that is like destructive, like
yeah.
so destructive. So I run the gamut on this stuff, and actually I think I prefer the cold and the snow to the sand.
I have to say, I think I agree with you. I think I agree with you in that respect. And by the way, I am a huge fan of the Signal. Just so you know.
That was my brother's film. He directed that, and we wrote it together.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that movie.
Oh, wonderful.
I was then, and I still am, but 11, 12 years later, it holds up really well.
Good. I will let him know. He'll be so thrilled to hear that.
One thing you also do that really helps with the story is that cabin. The cabin in the snow. The cabin in the woods in the snow.
Yeah.
And what you and Charlie do there, we really feel the claustrophobia, but also there's a lot of negative space in there that Charlie plays with. And it really feeds into the confusion and the hypothermia that's setting in.
Yeah.
And that plays so well. And we feel the claustrophobia and the focus on just trying to get one little spark of something lit. And that plays just really speaks volumes as to True's mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And it just works so beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah, that's just a real cabin that we found in outside of Anaconda, Montana, kind of up near a little place called Discovery, which is just up in the mountains in Montana. And we shot that all. Actually, a majority of the cabin work inside was shot during the summer, believe it or not.
Wow.
So that became about dressing the window correctly. We had like little bits of like kind of ephemera that we would drop through cracks in the roof. And, you know, the sound design plays a huge part in this. And I give a lot of credit to Danny Pagan and Patrick Ciccone, who did such a great job on the sound design in this movie. But yeah, shooting that, we shot it all out in 2 days. Now, some of the interstitial stuff, like leaving and coming into the cabin, we were smart enough to shoot during the winter, but everything inside was just me and Charlie and Wyatt sitting in there, you know, and just shooting it like almost, this will sound silly, but we kind of shot it like a cooking show because it's just like a lot of business. It's a lot of him working with stuff and doing stuff, and there's no real dialogue. So it's just a lot of stuff. So I had a beat sheet that I put together. And every scene, you know, Wyatt would review the beat sheet, like the things he had to go through. And then we would just do 3 or 4 takes from different angles of him going through the motions. And, it was claustrophobic for sure in there because there were like 3 or 4 guys sitting in this tiny cabin shooting all these like little beats. And, and it was hot as heck, you know, so hot in there. Which is ironic because it's supposed to look cold, but man, we were dying, and it was really dusty. The floor was like this really fine sediment that if you moved, it just sent up this like super fine. We'd walk out of the cabin every day, just looking like we came out of like a flour mill or something.
Oh my God!
So covered in this fine dust, it was crazy.
Oh my God. Another visual aspect of this film that is so key to True's character. How many rodeos did you hit to shoot footage at rodeos? And then to incorporate that in your editing process, and you mentioned the sound.
Yeah.
The sound is also interlinked with the rodeos because you've got to have that sound. Here again, we can either blame or thank Taylor Sheridan for reintroducing the Westerns and rodeos to the American population.
Right. Yeah, we did about 4 rodeos. We put one of our own on as well. And that was kind of the most fun process in a way, because you would just find a rodeo. We'd call their rodeo committee and the stock contractor, tell them what we were up to, and they were always like, yeah, come on down, let's do it. So we would just pay actual bareback riders we'd pay them like a SAG stunt fee and pay their entries, and all they had to do is wear the costume. So our guys would enter these rodeos, ride, and then the the rodeo were always cool enough to then put the rodeo on pause, and the announcer would tell everybody what's going on, and then Wyatt and Charlie and like the sound guy would run out into the middle of the arena and then pick Wyatt up from, like, he just hit the ground, he gets up, and now he's leaving the arena. That's sort of like the most basic way how we stitched together, but it gets a lot more complicated than that, because we also put on our own rodeo so that we could do a lot of the close-ups of Wyatt on the bucking rig and then mm-hmm. on horses in the chutes. And so, you know, with a very small crew, you're suddenly tracking four or five different variables to make sure that you get all the pieces to put it together. So you have to track what color horse did the rider ride at that mm-hmm. rodeo, and what color shirt was he wearing, and this and that. And then when we put on our own rodeo, we had to coordinate with our stock contractor to make sure he had those horses. And it became a real sort of puzzle that my editor, Glenn Garland, and I spent a considerable amount of time, like, putting together and finessing and making sure it all, like, fit together. And both of us were really happy with how all the rodeo stuff turned out, because, you know, it was a lot of threads to track, I think it comes across as just pretty fluid, but the process of making that look fluid was not fluid. It was not an easy road. It was a lot of cobbling together.
We know Wyatt can ride a horse. That's a given, right? Especially given his parentage. He can ride a horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, he allowed himself to be buried in snow. Was he brave enough to actually get on one of the broncs, one of the bucking broncs?
He was brave enough, but I wouldn't have let him. I didn't let him. That's so dangerous.
Yep.
Like bronc riding, and then even more specifically bareback bronc riding, because there's two types of bronc riding. There's saddle and bareback. And bareback is well known to be the absolute most dangerous of all the rodeo sports. Bull riding gets all the kind of attention, but bareback is, like, viciously dangerous, which is partially why it shows that particular event. I think it's a good visual metaphor, but mm-hmm. it also is just the most kinetic and raw and dangerous. So I wouldn't have let him get on. I mean, I think he maybe sat on one in the chute, mm-hmm. but we would not have hit that chute open, not in a million years. That just would have been an absolute disaster.
Yeah, and you would never get insured on a film ever again, Carlisle.
No way. Yeah, we wouldn't mess around like that. But Wyatt's a super brave game guy. He'll do whatever, and he would do a lot of crazy things. But that was a line we did not want to cross.
How long did your editing process end up being? Because of not only the rodeo sequences, but in taking us in and out of True's mind's eye and what he's seeing, because it's done so seamlessly.
Yeah, it took it probably in total, I mean, post-production, like, all in was probably 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
But part of that is just, like, again, budgetary. I mean, I was always given what I needed, but I was never given more than I needed. So what you end up doing when you don't have money is you have to spend your own time.
Yeah.
So it became a lot of, you know, us, me and the producers that were helping with post, really looking at, like, what we had time to do and how to maximize it. So when it came to color grading or the sound design or the editing... and by the way, I had incredible teams in all three facets of that, and everybody was so generous with their time because they really believed in the movie. So they always gave more than they were expected to. Glenn Garland, Danny Pagan, Patrick Ciccone, Ethan Schwartz at Light Iron, they were all so generous with their time because they really saw what I was trying to do. But it took a while. And believe it or not, some of the snowfall in it is we had to do some CG to make things look continuity-wise correct.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot, but there were days where it was really cloudy and windy, but the snow just wasn't falling in that moment. It would sort of be flurries that would come in and out. And so in order to create continuity, you have to fill in those gaps. So that became another challenge, is trying to find, we have no money for CG, so working with people, you know, abroad who do CG but don't really do snow. And so I would just sit on my computer at home and, like, try to, you know, I don't have the language of CGI, but I would try to say, look, we need to have the flakes bigger in the forefront. They need to be more out of focus in the background, and then we need the parallax of the ones closer to camera moving faster than the ones in the background. And in the end, I don't think anybody could tell that there is some CGI falling snow in that movie.
I never would have known without you telling me just now.
But that took me months to get correct. Months. And just me and my editor, Glenn, we'd I think since given up our editing studio. So we were just approving shots at home on our own laptops.
Oh, my.
And then trying to reintegrate that stuff back into the film and making sure the color timing on it was correct. Because, you know, when you apply a CG shot to the film, it can change the look of the film. So suddenly we have to recolor things. And that's all super into the weeds. But the broad strokes are, it was immensely challenging to try to create a really polished finished product with very little resources. And it just became about using what limited time we had to the absolute max, you know?
Wow. This would be nothing without your cast. And I have to say, your casting, be it for your principals of Wyatt and Dennis and Mary and Tom and Johnny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic casting, but also your background players, the locals,
yes.
You know, all of that. The authenticity is wonderful.
Yeah.
But I will admit, seeing Mary McDonald play in a modern Western, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
This is like one of the greatest castings ever, because immediately her big debut.
Post-Civil War. That she was willing to participate. I mean, look, the role that she did was never it was never written as a really big role with a lot of dialogue. So I was really extremely flattered that she was willing to come in. I think she loved the script and she really understood this was about true. And then that's, you know, it's like those little supporting roles.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some people realize, some people don't, that the supporting cast really makes all the difference in your movie.
Yeah.
Because Wyatt could have the best performance of his lifetime, for example, but if the people around him just aren't up to the task, it just suddenly everything feels awkward or lopsided. But when you have such great actors like Mary in those smaller roles, doing a lot with her face and her expressions,
mm-hmm.
and her body language, like, that stuff elevates the movie. It, like, makes the small stuff feel like something, rather than just like, oh, hey, Mom, bye, Mom. Suddenly there's this, like, unspoken, you know, exchange of energy between the characters, because you have such a good actress in the role,
mm-hmm.
who's embodying it and cares about it. So, you know, like the scene at the dinner table when she's kind of has to be, you know, she sort of gets a little bit sidelined by Dennis. There's a lot going on in her face and her expressions that just tell a completely sort of different story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that stuff's really, really powerful. I'm sure there are a lot of people wish he was in it more, you know, I do too, but you know, at the end of the day, it was really about true.
Yeah.
And everybody was so great about supporting that journey.
And I do have to say, the father-son dynamic between Dennis and Wyatt as True and George, wow. So believable. Yeah. So palpable. Yeah. And that they're constantly at loggerheads with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the way Dennis played it was really cool. He brought sort of like a slight twinkle in his eye, a little bit of a wry sense of humor to it. I think that role could just as, I think the way a lot of people would have chosen to play it, the obvious decision would have been really stoic, never talks, angry, you know, authoritarian type dad. And Dennis brought like an ease and a charm to it that's like, this feels more realistic and also feels a little more damning because he has a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. So he just feels more dimensional than just like an angry, quiet dad that like never says I love you. You know what I mean? I think it's a little more interesting that Dennis has got a sense of humor and ribs his son and kind of smiles and laughs. It's cool. I really like how he played and what he brought to that character.
Yeah, and just watching Dennis and Wyatt together is really I mean, Dennis on his own, talking to Johnny's character of Caleb, talking with Mary's character, that's great. But then when you get Wyatt and Dennis together, father, son, that just, the authenticity leaps off the screen, Carlisle.
Yeah, they were the right men for the job. They sort of flipped into those characters and really just kind of became them. And it kind of made, you know, my job a lot easier as a first-time director, especially because, you know, they just kind of became those people. And so it became just about watching them do their thing. And, you know, very rarely did I say, I call BS on that, you know, because mm-hmm. I think they were just sort of hooked into it.
Now, I've got to ask you, I got one last question for you, Carlisle. Mm-hmm. First feature film directorial under your belt. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about yourself as a director in making Broke that you can now take forward into future directorial projects?
Well, I learned a ton of stuff, but I'd say if I had to pick one lesson that I learned that's probably the most important, it's that, look, this took so long to make that I learned that I can withstand a lot of problems when I make it. And I think that it's just about sticking with it. You know, because your instincts are your instincts and your taste is your taste. Those things will evolve and sort of get nudged over time and you'll get feedback and you kind of hone that stuff over time. But I think the most important thing is just like hanging in there and sticking with it. And that's what I learned is that you have to do that. And luckily I did.
And let's not forget that you'd rather shoot in snow than in the sandy desert.
Yeah, I love both, but if I had to pick, yes.
Oh, Carlisle, job so well done. A beautiful, beautiful film.
Much.
I cannot wait to see what you bring us next.
Thank you. Well, I can't wait to share my next thing with the world, whatever that might be.
Looking forward to it. Carlisle, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. And hopefully we'll chat again in the future.
Yes, I would love that. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you, Carlisle. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And that was Carlisle Eubank talking about Broke. And you can watch Broke right now on a multiplicity of digital platforms, such as Prime Video, Apple TV, and more. So now we're going to shift gears with the last gunfight. And yes, I'm sure you can hear the glee and imagine the smile on my face talking about this one as well, and James Bamford, who has become a fun pal. One of my favorite directors and a fantastic guy in general. It's funny because we chat so often that only letting a couple of months go by without talking is like going through withdrawals. He's a fantastic director. He came up through the stunt world as a stuntman, a stunt coordinator, second unit director, and ultimately feature director So you know that his action is going to be spot on in every film. His films are always action-packed. They boast excellent casting, superlative, well-choreographed and executed action, and solid stories. Some of my fave Bamford films include Shadowland, Air Force One Down, Utopia, Man with No Past, and High Ground. Now, anyone who has seen a James Bamford film already, and if you haven't, get thee to your computer and start logging in to check these out digitally. There are several things about James's films. One, he has an amazing producing and story partner in Stephen Paul. And as I mentioned, just listening to the two of them together is a kick in the ass. Stephen is credited with the story for The Last Gunfight, with script by J.D. Zeich. Stephen is also the producer. James also has core actors and production department heads who he collaborates with on many of his films, notably his fight choreographer, Radoslav Parvanov, for one, and actor John Voight, who is working with James for the fourth time with The Last Gunfight. And James shoots his films at New Boyana Studios in Bulgaria. What I love about James shooting at New Boyana is that when I see his films, it feels like the golden age of movies, where films were shot on the lot at MGM or Fox or Universal. You recognize buildings, you recognize certain streets on the studio lot and how they're being implemented for this particular film. It's wonderful. James is now with this film, The Last Gunfight. James thinks he has now utilized all of the streets, sets, and buildings at New Boyana. And something I dearly love in this film, there's some great tongue-in-cheek nods to a prior film of direct nods to a prior film of James's that was shot there. And those of you that know James's work, you're going to recognize it when you see it. But the rest of you, get some eagle eyes, and I think you'll find it too. I think The Last Gunfight is James's biggest endeavor to date. He's got a large ensemble cast, which he hasn't had before. He generally keeps his cast minimal. But this is just massive. And these are some of the biggest and most impressive action sequences that will actually have you thinking of John Wick, especially given all the action disciplines that are employed. This is also a story that expands beyond what we've seen from James before. The Last Gunfight takes place in a ruthless underground tournament where the world's top assassins fight to the death. Sounds like a cool tournament, actually. And yes, there's betting involved. But hidden among them is a rogue crew with its own agenda. Infiltrate the competition, survive the bloodbath, and take down the mastermind pulling the strings. As alliances shift and the bodies pile up, the real battle isn't just for survival. It's all about revenge and a fortune worth killing for. John Voight stars, along with Adam Woodward, Charlotte Vega, Shayna West, all of whom have worked with James before. The superb Radha Serbagea. I can never say Radha's last name correctly, so I'm sorry if I screwed it up. But he is wonderful, and he's such a lovely man. I interviewed him many years ago for Angelina Jolie's directorial In the Land of Blood and Honey. He's wonderful. He's one of those guys that has a little twinkle in his eye no matter what he's doing. And thanks to James in The Last Gunfight, there's a new actor on my radar now. The scene-stealing and oh-so-deadpan funny, Derbla Molly, or Malloy. She is, number one, she's not a 20, 30-something. She is ARP age, which I love seeing since I am in that age category. I like to see those of us paying our $16 a year for ARP cards. I like to see us have jobs and be acknowledged and celebrated. And boy, oh boy, Derbla is fantastic here. And I can't wait to see her, see James especially, utilize her in what I hope will be a sequel to The Last Gunfight. My fingers and toes are crossed. So as usual, in this exclusive interview, James and I break it all down for you, highlighting the action-packed and fun nature of the film, particularly the character dynamics and John Voight's performance. John gets to have fun with this role, and I think you're going to enjoy it when you see the film. Interesting is that this go-round, James is working with Ivan Vatsov as his cinematographer and a camera operator. He's not working with Frank Meyer this time. But don't worry. You know, Ivan was a camera operator on Expendables 3, so he knows how to shoot action. He knows how to use light to its best advantage. And I got to tell you, there are some real money shots in this film where Ivan captures the sky in twilight at sunset. And it is pink, and it's beautiful, and it's gorgeous, and it's not enhanced. That is what it looks like. So I'm a fan of Ivan's as he steps into this role as cinematographer. And he brought some of his own unique visual elements to play. And we talk about the casting of this one, and how this casting was a bit different than James's other films, as the actors had to be able to execute the action sequences themselves because there are so many one-ers. There are so many one-shots in some of these big action sequences. There is one sequence in the third act, and all I will tell you is that every one of the major players in the ensemble, and it's over a dozen, it's like high noon in the round. It is spectacular. And they had to be doing their own stunts. So that adds something to the casting process, which meant James had to start casting very early for this shoot. And of course, we go in depth about Radoslav's complex yet fluid fight choreography and some new areas of discussion that James and I haven't hit on with his other films, the sound design, and the great attention paid to the different weaponry and environs, as well as bringing the score in along with all of the Foley and the weaponry and dialogue. James has a very interesting process, and he does so much pre-prep, even when it comes to sound. So I think you're going to, filmmakers out there, I think you're going to like hearing what he has to say. And you soundies out there, I think you're going to like hearing what James has to say about sound design on his films, and notably in this film. And of course, the pre-planning and physical preparation for The Last Gunfight, due to the physical complexity throughout the studio lot, this is where geometry, you may actually find a use for geometry when you do a film like this. I'm not sure, but maybe. So stick with geometry if you're in school. At least take one semester of it. You might have a use for it. So that's all I have to say. Take a listen to this fun and fascinating conversation with the fabulous director, James Bamford, talking about The Last Gunfight.
Hello.
And who is this?
James Bamford.
Hey, stranger.
Surprise.
How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Fine. You know, it's been a whole 2 months today since we last talked. I just don't know how I've survived 2 months without talking to you again.
Right. And there's another one coming right after this.
Good. Good.
But so we just finished the sound mix on this week, which you're going to, I guarantee you're going to love as well. But let's talk about The Last Gunfight.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm very happy, number one, I get you all to myself today, and I don't have to share you with your partner in crime. It's a lot. It is a lot of fun having both of you together. I got to tell you, James. But the one message I have for Stephen, though, since this was his story idea for the last gunfight, he needs to get to work now on a sequel for me.
Okay, I'll pass that on.
This film, it is so much fun. Fun is the operative word here.
It is, right?
Oh, my God. You know, your other films, they've all been very hardcore. And, yes, action, you know, action-filled. This one is action-fueled and filled as well. But we are having so much fun with the character dynamics and particularly getting to see John Voight really play, masterminding this revenge-fueled takedown of Skull, and then bringing in all the puzzle pieces. I just fell in love with that, and watching him get into character and give little side glances and things like that was hilarious. And then you bring in Dibble Malloy as Trudy, one of the best characters you have ever introduced.
Isn't she wonderful?
We
loved her so much.
I smiled watching this film, James. I admit it. I was having that much fun. And of course, Radha, who I first learned of him back with In the Land of Blood and Honey, Angelina Jolie's movie, back in 2010 or 11. And I interviewed him for that movie. Fascinating guy. And to see his trajectory in American films over the past 14, 15 years is amazing. And he is so perfectly cast here. This is, I think, the biggest principal cast that you have had in a few films.
It's a huge ensemble. It's a giant ensemble. His role was written for him.
Oh. So. All of your characters, and you bring back a lot of your playmates. You know, Adam Woodward is back. Charlotte Vega is back. You've got Alex back. I love her character of Frenchie. Shayna West is back. Interestingly, though, and I need to find out how this happened and how this new collaboration was, Frank was not back as your cinematographer. You now have a new cinematographer on this film, Ivan Vatsov.
Ivan is someone that we looked into very early, all the way back to Shadowland, actually.
Wow.
And Ivan was, it turned out that he ended up going on to Hellboy, one of the sequels of Hellboy, and we couldn't get him. And we were interviewing him, and we were interviewing Frank, and, you know, we were talking to a couple people. And so it ended up to be Frank, and Ivan wasn't available, and we just made the decision for a few reasons, visually wise and, you know, visual language wise and whatnot, because of what I wanted to do in the film, that we were going to go with Ivan on this one specifically.
Yeah,
and he's very skilled, as you can see.
Yeah,
with the moving shots and the wonders that I wanted to design, and he got it right away. He just came in guns blazing, ha ha ha. no pun intended. But he embraced my vision and just went for it. And, you know, no questions asked. And I challenged him a lot. And he stepped up to the plate and knocked it out of the park every time. So, very happy with him.
Oh, my God. The result, the proof is in the pudding here, James. I mean, I knew of Yvonne's work, his camera work in particular, that he did on Expendables 3 as a camera operator. So, I'm also not surprised to see that with this film, he's also the A camera operator, is he not?
Correct. Yeah. And as I was just saying in another interview, for the stunt sequences, for the fight sequences, I have a stunt camera operator, which is the fight choreographer. which I used to do myself.
Yeah.
Just because of, well, one, the safety involved when you're, you know, the camera's right in the middle of a multiple opponent fight sequence, especially when they're swinging swords and they're going over your head and very close to you and whatnot.
Yeah.
I've put myself in that position before, but I don't expect our regular camera operators to be put in that position as much as they, you know, feel confident. It's very dangerous. And number two, the fight choreographer or the stunt coordinator knows the fight better than anyone,
yeah.
You know, except for myself, who's also been to all the rehearsals and whatnot. So that's the choice. But yes, Yvonne was the A camera operator on every other sequence in the entire film, except for the, you know, the long take fight sequences.
Once again, your fight choreographer, Radoslav, is so good with this fight, with this fight choreography, because this isn't just one man on three or one man on two. You've really got a round robin happening here,
which you
don't see too often. When we've got the huge center square and, I wonder where I've seen that center square before. My, I'm not sure. But which I fell in love with that, because throughout the film I'm seeing like the green building, the green front building that was a cafe in Man with No Past, and all these little touchstones, and of course the movie theater marquee out front. It goes Man with No Past, Falling in Love Again, and then playing in the theater is Man with No Past, as we have a fight sequence in the theater. So I got a kick out of all those little touchstones, James. I got to tell you, they were not wasted on me.
Good, yeah. I thought it'd be fun to have a sword fight going on the screen at the same time we're having a sword fight in quote unquote real life.
Well, and of course, seeing the theater marquee in front with the Man with No Past, and I chuckled, and it's Falling in Love Again. And of course, as we see the film progress, yeah, that's kind of foreshadowing for something that may or may not be unfolding. But Radoslav's, that camera work and that fight choreography, the constant movement, because I'm looking at a lot of these oneers that you've got, and this is wow, and you really took advantage of everything that New Boyana. Is there any street you haven't used within New Boyana?
Not a one.
We
shot everything.
You blew my mind. But that round robin in the middle of the square was just absolute killer. And no pun intended there. Radoslav did an amazing job, not only with the choreography, but with that camera work. The action camera work throughout the film is exemplary, James. I think it's some of the finest that I've seen.
Thank you so much.
On your films. As well as the actual fights.
We did try something a little different in the final, quote-unquote, last gunfight sequence with our camera work. We brought in a camera operator on rollerblades.
What?
Because I wanted to cover... You know, it starts in the circle, and then it goes all the way down the street and all the way down around bars and then down an alley and over a fence and all that sort of thing. So it's a lot of ground to cover to expect a cameraman to run and keep up with all of the performers who are running around and shooting each other. So there's been a very specialized camera operator who I've been trying to utilize on several of the films, and this was the only time he was available, so we designed that particular fight for him specifically.
Wow, the fluidity is fantastic, and what we're seeing in terms of action and reaction with the fight, with the choreography itself, is just fantastic. And the fact that this is being done, this isn't underground, under a warehouse, up on a 60-foot high catwalk. This is out in broad daylight, wide open. no obstructions, yep. And we are getting the full flavor and taste of everything that's happening. And I fell in love with that watching it, James. I just fell in love with it. Because we don't see that. We just don't see that. We might have seen this back in the 1940s in a John Wayne Western or a John Ford directed Western with everything out in the open. But you don't really see too much of that anymore. So much of the fight choreography gets cloaked. But here, to shoot it the way you did, we get to see everything.
The key was casting. I mean, the camera work, of course, but everyone we cast was vetted very carefully for not only their, you know, their character ability, acting-wise, but also their physicality and their skill sets in martial arts and or parkour, acrobatics, and the like. So that's how we were able to pull this off, was casting the right people for the job.
Wow. How challenging was the casting, or how lengthy a process did you have on this one? Because of the sheer number of the ensemble, and even the peripheral characters within the big, you know, competition, all of them are very skilled. This could not have been that easy to cast.
It wasn't. It took a long time. You know, we were right down to the wire because, as you know, during the prep period of a film, we have to fit actors with costume and do hair makeup tests and wigs and all sorts of things. So we need bodies to put in the costumes and do all these tests with. And you need those, you need well in advance. You also need bodies to put into rehearsal because they don't just show up on set and start fighting without having rehearsed a lot. So it was a much bigger endeavor than our other films thus far, for sure.
So how did this tax you mentally and physically with this much bigger endeavor?
You know, I had sort of been, funny enough, I'd been prepping for this film physically because I also had to do a lot of running around on set, more so on this film because of just the nature, all the ground that was covered geographically. So I started very early on, I think, in December. We shot this in July, but I started very early on in December, just the previous year when we were shooting Utopia, I started, or even before that, probably November or October, I started back heavily at the gym and training. So before prep in the morning, going to the office, and before set, I'd spent a lot of time, at least a couple hours, in the gym, and I carried that through all the films leading up to this film because I knew this film was going to, you know, take a lot out of me and for me to keep up with what was going on and energy wise. So I came in really strong physically in as well as mentally on this film. And it was summertime. We were able to shoot outside. It was nice and warm. Our biggest challenge was fighting shadows as the sun moves across the sky throughout the day for continuity. But that aside, you know, we had a great time.
Well, and of course, I love it after we have our big round robin. And then, of course, we have Jimmy who takes off down an alley, ends up in a building, and you've got people coming out of doorways. You must have had another 60 people gunning for him. And then when he finally emerges from the building, it's nighttime. It's evening.
Yeah, we shot that in real time. We shot that in real time, too, on the same day.
Wow.
And we planned it to be nighttime. As you can see, it's all lit properly and whatnot in the street. So you have to plan for those things, of course. But we started that sequence daytime, and we planned. We go inside, and we're down the hall and upstairs and all that. And when we spill out back onto the street,
And I have to tell you, when he emerges, even before he emerges, and you can see through the windows of the building that, okay, it looks like it's nighttime or dusk, I have to commend you and Ivan. The lensing and the lighting for that outdoors at that moment, that is one of the most beautiful early evening lighting examples that I have seen in a long time. It is beautiful. And it just...
I really love what he did. I really love what he did. And credit to him.
I mean, it's just... It's gorgeous. And it fits so well, you know, coming out from these these narrow corridors again. You love these narrow corridors and spaces, I'll tell you. But we come out of there and the green sickliness there and everything is coming to a head. We get downstairs and Jimmy goes outside and he's like last man standing. And... Not really, but we get that impression, and it is so, the color of the sky, the clouds, just gorgeous, James. There, you have outdone yourself with this one, and how you have pushed your own limits.
Thank you. It was big. It was definitely a lot of scope and scale and characters, And we wanted this one to be more saturated, you know, more colorful.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more humor in it than before in the other films. And I've said from the beginning, this is akin to, you know, a Fellini film with its cast of characters.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic on every level, James. How long did it take you in pre-production to map this out because of the amount of space that you were utilizing? That could not have been easy.
Well, because of, I'll tell you a little secret. We started discussing this movie on the set of Utopia, which was shot in December of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Paul was sitting beside me at the directing monitor. And Stephen was watching the director's cut of Man with No Past on his laptop sitting beside me as I was, you know, on set directing. And Stephen was going, oh, my God, oh, that was amazing. Oh, God. I kept looking down, going, what are you watching? What are you looking at? And he was, you know, talking about the action. He really loved the film, the love story and everything, but he was talking about the action. He said, We have to make a whole movie like this with the whole movie is a one-er, which was the original plan for The Last Gunfight.
Uh-huh.
Until it morphed into a different story and more characters and everything else, as you see. But right there sitting beside me on his laptop, Steven started writing an outline and started writing about a priest and, you know, this and that and this woman and this guy and, you know, all these ideas started flowing between us while we were on set. And that's where the script started. I mean, it started with a very, like, a one-sheet outline. And he came up with the title right then and there, you know?
Wow.
So he left, and at the end of Utopia, I was there in December, and because of... You know, the script was starting to get written. I walked around the studio with my phone and just walked around and went, and then I think I should do a fight that goes down the street and goes into the movie theater and we'll come out here and we'll spill out in the theater and we'll do blah, blah, blah. And I started planning way back then, which was December. We didn't shoot until July. So that's how long... previous to shooting that the planning started.
Oh my God. I know Ainsley's messaging me. I only have a couple more minutes with you. But I have to ask you with this one about your sound. Because we are in so many different places, we are outside, we are in alleys, we are in an open garage, we are within the ballroom, the competition ballroom itself, in the hotel, and we have so many different kinds of armament, so many different kinds of blades.
Yep.
In the round one, all the different hidden weapons that we see and hear.
Yep.
How challenging was it with the sound design, working with your sound guys on the mix and the edit?
Well, in the temp sound design, I'm very specific. In the director's cut, with trying to vary all of the different for the template for the sound design. And then I kept checking in on it with Patrick, who's our sound engineer. I was very specific about giving different sounds for each gun and different sounds for each blade and, you know, varying levels of contact and gunshots and bullet wounds and, you know, everything else. So Patrick's pays very, very close attention to detail, and he does a magnificent job. And having just spent the last week with him in the studio, I'm very happy with what he's done.
I'm ecstatic with everything that you've done on this film, James. Just incredible. I love this one so much. I can't tell you. I'm going to be buying it. I have to have this. Seriously, I do want to see a sequel with these characters returning, because they are so wonderful and their relationships and dynamics are fantastic and so relatable and likable. I want to see.
And the setup at the end is made to ease into a sequel, most definitely. So
yeah.
I'm sure you'll be seeing something.
Good.
I think the last gunfight thus far is my favorite. The poster for the last gunfight is my favorite. The theatrical poster is my favorite artwork that we've had done, if you've seen that.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. It's fantastic.
It's got every character on the, every single character of the 5 million that we have in the movie are on the poster, which I loved.
It's very much like an Expendables 3 or 4 kind of deal. With everybody but the kitchen sink on there. And if we look hard enough, I bet we're going to find that too.
Yeah. You will. You got to study it.
I will. James, as always, this has been so much fun. And Ainsley's emailing me to finish up, wrap up. So I'll be good, girl. I love this one so much. Thank you, as
good.
Always,
thanks,
my friend. And until next time, go make me more,
ma'am.
Make me more movies.
Yes, ma'am. I plan to.
Thanks.
I plan to.
Thanks, James. Have a great weekend. And that was James Bamford talking about The Last Gunfight. And as I said, you can see The Last Gunfight right now on a myriad of digital platforms. So check it out. It just dropped on May 27th, right after Memorial Day weekend. So get in there and take a look at it. It is a lot of fun. So that is all the time we have today. Yes, I know we went over. We're back in the groove, going beyond an hour. But don't worry, because I'll be back next week with some more interesting interviews for you. But in the meantime, make sure to check out the website, behindthelensonline.net, for more exclusive interviews, including quite a few For Your Consideration Emmy Artisan interviews. A bunch of stuff on Cross, The Boys, and a really interesting interview with the costume designer for House of David. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.